listening to a message from City Church, located in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. For more information on City Church, or for additional resources, including service times, recommended readings, and additional audio, please visit citychurchpa.org.
How many of you brought a Bible today, just out of curiosity? Okay, a few, all right, that's good. I can't go anywhere without a Bible, I'll be honest with you. I started carrying a man bag around just so I could have room for a Bible. You know, the Bible is the most amazing book that's ever been written. You just can't say enough about the Bible. It's actually a collection of 66 individual books that were written by some 40 different authors over a period of 1,500 years. Now, stop and think about that for a moment. 1,500 years. That would, 1,500 years ago goes back to 500 AD. You know what was happening at 500 AD? Those of you who study history. I mean, the Roman Empire was just then ending. The Vikings were discovering how to pillage and loot. Game of Thrones, you know, it all started 1,500 years ago. I mean, it was just, the Mayans were in South America. That's how long ago 1,500 years. It'd be 1,000 years before the King James Bible would be written. That is a long time. And yet, that book that took 1,500 years to write, spanning all that time, tells one story. The story of God. And it's the story of how the Lord God Almighty made a special covenant with his creation man who had sinned and had to be banished from his presence. And yet he reconciled them back through his own atoning blood. You know, and I'll tell you something. I'm an author. And it is hard to maintain a theme, a thread, from the beginning of a book to the end without losing track somehow. And I write Wilbur, you know, Wilbur will attest to that, right? It's a challenge. And yet, here's 40 authors over 15 centuries. And it's one unified story. The only explanation for that is that there's one author, the Holy Spirit. And it's that Holy Spirit who spoke and inspired men to write the scriptures that God had intended in his word. And really one of the most amazing of those 66 books that compile the Bible is the book that we're going to look at today, the book of Esther. And Esther really is unique for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which, that here you have a book that's in the book that's a story of God, and the name of God does not occur in the book of Esther. Not once. Not only do you not hear God's name mentioned, you don't hear sin or the law of God or worship or prayer. And further, the heroes of the story, which is, of course, Esther and her cousin Mordecai, they kind of appear rather secular in their lifestyle. And yet, despite these factors, this book has always been seen as one that's been inspired by God, accepted as God's word. And the reason is because the events in this story are so impossible to imagine had it not been for the hand of God at work. So I'm going to go over the book of Esther. You might be familiar with it, but bear with me because it's such a great story. But it begins right in chapter 1, verse 1. It introduces King Xerxes. Now, his Hebrew name in some Bibles you'll see, it says Ahasuerus, the king Ahasuerus, but that's the Hebrew name. And most of us are familiar with the Greek name Xerxes, so I'm going to use that. And he reigned in Persia. At the time it says he ruled over 127 provinces. Now, Persia was in what we would call present-day Iran. And this kingdom that Xerxes had stretched all the way from Egypt to what we would call almost to China, India to Egypt, up to Turkey, and even parts of Greece. It was huge. Xerxes' grandfather was Cyrus the Great, who's, of course, mentioned in Ezra and Daniel and even Isaiah. And his father was Darius the Great, who's also mentioned in Daniel. And Darius expanded the kingdom beyond what his grandfather Cyrus had done. And by the time Xerxes comes along, he's handed really one of the greatest empires in the world. And in fact, in Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, it mentions that King Xerxes would be the greatest king of the Persians. The story is set in what is called the winter capital. It's called Susa, not John Philip Sousa, but S-U-S-A. Susa was a city that was one of the four capital cities of Persia. It was comfortable, apparently. And the story opens with King Xerxes having a party that lasts 180 days. These guys knew how to party. And after you partied for 6 months, it's hard to come down, right? So Xerxes comes up, okay, we're going to end the party by having one more week of party. And it's sort of like, like we saw the fireworks, you know, you have the grand finale at the end, you know, the best part. So we're going to have the best. I'm saving the best for last. I'm going to bring out the queen, Queen Vashti. So here they are. They're all excited. And Vashti now, she's not too excited about this. Now, Queen Vashti was the daughter of the Babylonian king. Babylonia had been conquered by Persia. And she was the daughter of the Babylonian king Belshazzar. And she was granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So this girl comes from some rich royal blood. And she obviously thought she was more hotsy-tots, that she didn't have to come at every beck and call of the king. So we don't know exactly why. The scripture doesn't tell us, but she didn't come to the party. She got invited. She said, no, I'm not going. Well, now, this didn't go over well with the king. And so he has a hissy fit, and he bans her for life to her own palace. You just get out of my sight, and she's gone. Now, chapter 2 of Esther opens with the king kind of regretting the fact that he did that, because he says now he doesn't have a beautiful wife anymore. He kind of misses her, so he needs a new wife. So what he does is he calls out for a beauty pageant. Over 127 countries, I need a new wife. So now the first Miss Universe contest, right, is taking place. And all these women are selected, and it just so happens, this is one of the many just so happens, that right there in the capital city was a Jewish man by the name of Mordecai. And he had been carried away from Judah in a captivity. He was in exile, done by Nebuchadnezzar during the Babylonian times. And he was a guardian of an orphan cousin of his, whose name was Hadassah in Hebrew, but she went by her Persian name, Esther, which in Persian language means star. She was a star. She was drop-dead gorgeous. And she won the contest, the local contest. And now all these women were brought one by one before the king. And guess what? Esther was number one. I mean, he was just so enraptured by her. Wow. I'm going to make you the king. So now, Esther becomes the queen of Persia. And, of course, this necessitates another party. All right. But now we find Mordecai coming into the story. And Mordecai is a real hero of this story, because he's keeping an eye on Esther. And he advises her, don't necessarily advertise the fact that you're a Jew. That might not be such a good idea. And he is apparently given some kind of position of authority, because he's now sitting in the gate, which was a position like a judge. And as he's there doing his whatever gate business, he overhears these two eunuchs of the king plotting an assassination plot against King Xerxes. So he gets the message to Esther. Esther gets it to the king, and the plot is foiled. These guys are then hung on the gallows. Now, you have to keep that episode in the back of your mind for a moment. It's just sort of it just happens and then the story goes on. But it becomes very important later. Chapter 3 opens by introducing the king's number one advisor, Haman. This is no relation to He-Man that Gus spoke about last week. Gus is not here, right? No relation to He-Man. This is Haman. And he's called Haman the Agagite. And five times he's referred to in the book of Esther, Haman the Agagite. Now, why that particular tag ending? Well, it turns out that this guy is 16 generations from King Agag, a king of the Amalekites that were enemies of Israel back to in the time of King Saul. And if you remember, King Saul was told that he was to destroy the Amalekites. He was supposed to kill them, all of them, down to the animals. And he didn't do that. We read in 1 Samuel 15, he failed to do so. And Prophet Samuel declared that because of your failure, the kingdom's going to be taken from you, and it would be given to another, which was David. Now, Haman is his descendant, and he is very proud of the fact that he's the number two man, stretched around in town, and everybody bows before him, except for this one guy, Mordecai. He doesn't bow. So Haman said, who is this guy anyway? Oh, that's Mordecai, the Jew. And as we discover that Mordecai is not just a Jew, he is a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin. King Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. So now, you can see the wheels now turn because Haman says, you know what? My descendants were almost killed by your descendant. Now, he decides he doesn't just want Mordecai dead, he wants all the Jews dead. And he decides that that's what he's going to endeavor to do. But because he's a very religious man in a pagan sense, he needs to find out what's the exact right time to have this extermination take place. So he goes to the village witch doctor, I don't know. They have these dice that they would throw to tell the fortune. And the dice were called Pur, P-U-R. And he needs a time, when would be the best time for this extermination to take place. Now, they're in the first month, so for ours, they don't call them by the same names we do, but we'll just to keep it simple, we're in the month of January. So he goes in and he says, can we do it in January? Nope. How about February? Nope. Nope. March. Whew. All the way out to December, 12 months out, before he can finally do it. I can just see old Haman. Really? I got to wait 12 months. The 13th day of the 12th month, perfect time. Haman's excited. Now he can do it. He goes in to see the king. And he sees King Xerxes, and he's got him all set up. He says, you know, there's these certain people, and they don't obey Persian laws. And then he even appeals to Xerxes' pocketbook. They don't even pay taxes, which I'm sure any politician is going to not be happy about. But again, now, Haman's a very smart guy. He says, you know what? I'm willing to take 10,000 silver pieces, silver talents, and put them into the treasury to cover the expenses of getting rid of these people. This is going to be on me. We'll wipe them all out. Not going to cost you a dime, Xerxes. Xerxes said, hey, you know, no sweat off my back. So he issues the edict that now all the Jews and all the world, the unknown world, are now going to be sentenced to death. Now, Mordecai, of course, hears this news. And this is tragic news. You've just been given a death sentence. It's not for a bunch of months out, but still, it's going to happen. A royal edict will happen. You can't change it. There's no avoiding it. There's no getting away from it. We are sentenced to death. And he knows that the only person that can possibly do anything about this is Esther. So we find in Esther chapter 4 this encounter. It starts in verse 8. Now, Mordecai also gave him is Hathach, the eunuch for Esther, a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and to plead with him on behalf of his people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Now Esther spoke back to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and said, "Yo, all the king's servants and all the people of king's provinces know." You know, listen, everybody knows this. This is, nobody can do this, what you're asking. If any man or woman, including a queen, goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. They're going to be put to death. Except for the one the king holds out the golden scepter, so that he might live. But as for me, I have not been called to come to see the king for these 30 days. King's just been forgot about me. I'm out of sight, out of mind for a month now. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And Mordecai told him to reply to Esther. "Do not think to yourself that it, in the king's palace you'll escape any more than any other Jews." In other words, you're on the block as well as us. "If you keep silent of this relief," I'm sorry, silent at this time, "relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place." Mordecai has faith. "But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So Esther makes the decision. And she even says, "If I perish, I perish. But I have to do this." So she gets herself all decked out, looking her best. And she goes in, and boy, you could almost imagine a scene where she realizes every step could be her last. And everybody's kind of watching, is the king going to respond? Because here she is, she's approached, she hasn't been called for. And the king, you know, he says, she's looking awfully good. Okay, yeah, there goes the scepter. Don't shoot her, she's good. And he wants to know, you know, "So why are you here, Queen Esther? What do you want?" And she just says, "Well, you know what? I'm having a party." Boy, if you want to know how to get to this guy, that was the best thing to say. "I'm having a banquet. I want to invite you. Oh, and then Haman too. Let him come." Hey, no better time than the present. So off they go. They go and are having a great time. And the king is enjoying himself so much. He says, "Esther, what do you want? I'll give you up to half my kingdom." She says, "Come back tomorrow. I want you to come back tomorrow. And then I'll tell you." Well, Haman, he's floating, man. He goes home. He's bragging to the wife. "Man, I am in tight with a king. The queen loves me. Life is good. Except for that stinking Mordecai. He doesn't bow to me. He sits right there on the city gate. It's like mocking me." And the wife says, "Haman, get with it. You need to build a gallows. Make him 75 feet high so that anybody in the whole city can see him, right? Whack this guy. And then go to the banquet." He said, "Hey, that's a good idea." So he has the gallows built. Now here's where our story just gets really fun. Meanwhile, back in the palace, King Xerxes can't sleep. And, you know, he's tossing and turning. And, you know, like us, sometimes you can't sleep. You get a book to read. You know, a book will be boring enough to put you back to sleep, right? And he picks a book called the Chronicle of Memorable Deeds book. And as he's looking through it, whew, hey, what about this? This guy Mordecai saved my life, and we didn't do anything for him. At just that moment, Haman shows up. Now, this really, to me, is one of the funniest scenes in the entire Bible. Right here, Esther chapter 6. This is great. "And the king said, 'Who's in the court?' And Haman had just entered the outer court to the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, 'Well, Haman's out there standing in the court.' And the king said, 'Oh, let him come in.' So Haman came in. And the king said, 'What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?' Haman says to himself, 'Whom would the king delight to honor other than me?' So Haman said to the king, 'Well, for the man the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble officials, and let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. Let them lead him to the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. King said, by gum, Haman, you got it. You nailed it. Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew. Oh, man, don't you wish you had a camera? I mean, that scene, just to look at his face, it would have been great. To Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Haman's day is about to go from bad to worse, okay? Because now he goes back and he's still got to go to the queen's second banquet. So he gets there and the king says, Queenie, come on, what's going on? What can I do to make you happy? She said, well, spare my life and my people. He said, what are you talking about? Well, there's been an edict against me and against our people. And he said, what? Who came up with that stupid idea? Haman is the villain. Now, the king is just, he's lost it for a second. Now, he does practice good anger management. So he decides, he just doesn't want to explode. So he decides he's going to go out into the courtyard, into the garden, to just kind of cool off a minute. Now, Haman, his goose is cooked. He's got it. The only thing he could do is appeal to Queen Esther, you know, like, hey, I'm sorry, it was a big mistake. And this is just so beautiful. At the precise moment the king returns from the garden, Haman loses his balance and he falls on Esther. And the king said, will he even insult the queen in my presence in my own house? Obviously, that was it for Haman. Immediately, Haman was taken away. He was hanged on the very gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Now, meanwhile, Mordecai is given Haman's position as number two man. And so the first order of business is to find a way to square the circle of the royal edict that's been created. Jews are to be killed in December. It's now March. The edict can't be changed. So Mordecai gets King Xerxes to make a caveat to the edict that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves against being killed. And this now was sent out to all the 127 provinces of the empire. Now the response is found in Esther chapter 8, verse 17. And in every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. And then the very next chapter gives the result, chapter 9, verse 1. Now in the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict was about to be carried out, on that very day, when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred, and the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. And that event, then, as the book of Esther concludes, was commemorated in a Jewish feast day known as the Feast of Purim, which is celebrated to this day. Now, that's the book of Esther. And what we can see in this book is what I call the invisible sovereign God. It begins with his divine intervention throughout the story. In fact, you know, every single event that I just related to you, each had a hand in what was eventually to happen, and they all had to happen in exactly that sequence and that timing. You know, you have Queen Vashti just arbitrarily deciding not to attend a banquet, which set the whole thing in motion. Esther, of all people, getting chosen to be queen, and she just happened to be a Jew. You find that she just happens to be related to an incredibly wise man by the name of Mordecai. And then Mordecai just happens to hear a murder plot. And then, which should have happened, saving the king's life should have been rewarded, but it gets forgotten until a very convenient time later. Haman plots to kill Mordecai, and yet he wants to kill all the Jews, but he uses lots to choose the date, which turns out to be very far in advance. Haman just happened to walk in at just the right moment. That is priceless. When the king's deciding who to honor, and he thinks it's him. And then Haman getting shamed to honor his former enemy, Mordecai. Haman falling on Esther's lap at just that one moment when the king was trying to cool off, and that sort of ended that. And then Haman getting hung on the very gallows that he had prepared for his enemy. Can you see? God was at work in every single one of these events. And just as God had delivered the Jews from Egypt, but in that case, what did you see? You saw where God was very visible. There were many miracles that were signs of God's presence. But what we see here is something different. You know, and I just can't get over the irony of Haman, who wanted all the Jews dead yesterday, but because he's so pagan, he knows he wants to trust the gods to give him the right time, and they keep tossing these dice, and they keep coming out further ahead, further on, to actually the last possible time it could be. What's the significance of that? Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." Because the death sentence was pushed out all that far, the Jews were given a chance, plenty of chance of time to prepare themselves, to defend themselves. You see, in Exodus, we see seen miracles. Here in Esther, we see unseen miracles. But is God any less at work here? And you know the timing. You know, Haman was ready to implement his plan instantly. But it just ironically, when he was coming in to institute the plan, God was instituting the plan for the Jews' salvation by honoring Mordecai. But what does that say? Ecclesiastes 3:1. For everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. God is in control. And yet, the individuals involved all made their own decisions. So there's also human responsibility here. And that's why I mentioned in the beginning, neither Mordecai nor Esther are particularly noble in the way that you look at, say, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the book of Daniel, who did not partake of the food and practices of the Babylonians. They were very Persian. Okay, in the way they lived, their lifestyle. And they didn't go through anything like a fiery furnace or a den of lions like they did in Daniel. Quite frankly, Mordecai gave Esther a choice that really wasn't much of a choice at all. Right? But here's a beautiful lesson for all of us. It does not take great faith to see great acts of God. It takes a great God who'll use anyone with faith to accomplish his will. And that's what Mordecai told Esther. If you don't do this, God will find someone else. And that incredible miracle would be by God's hand, acting through man's actions. And there's also something else that's missed, I think, in reading the book of Esther. This passage in chapter 8. Remarks that the good news that the Jews received, they knew they had a death sentence. I mean, they knew their days were numbered. But now they received this good news that came that they were going to be allowed to defend themselves. And in 8:16 states that the Jews, when they got this news, had light and gladness and joy and honor. They still had the death sentence. It was still in effect. But the good news brought them hope. And that hope brought them gladness and joy. Doesn't that sound like the gospel? Those of us who know the true consequences of our sin acknowledge that we deserve eternal punishment. Yet we accept and believe the good news of salvation in Jesus Christ. Even in this earthbound state that is ravaged by sin and disease and despair and all the rest, we too have light and gladness and joy and honor, because we know we have been given the victory before we see that victory. Just as Joseph noted to his brothers in Genesis 50:20, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring as many people should be saved as they are today." Nothing can thwart the plans and purposes of God. You know, Satan was paying attention in Genesis 3:15 when God pronounced to him that the seed of the woman will crush your head, and you will bruise the heel. Thank you. Bruise the heel of that one that would do that. He knew that his demise, his defeat, was going to come through the seed of the woman. So what does he do? He needs to kill that Messiah. So what does he do? He tries to destroy all the Jewish babies during the time of Moses. He tries to kill all the Jews during a time of Esther. He whispered into Herod's ear to kill all the babies during a time of Jesus. And it's true, many children were killed. There was weeping in Ramah, but Satan's efforts to kill the Messiah failed. God's plan and purpose is sure. His promises will never fail. And the very gallows that Haman had planned to use against him were used to use against Mordecai were used against him. The very cross that Satan believed was going to end Jesus' life was the very victory that came to us through his resurrection. Whew. Now, that's a great book. And if I can just sort of take a takeaway from Esther, if Romans 8:28 is really true, that God does work all things together for good to those who love God and call according to his purpose, he'll use even most unusual things for his purpose. I don't see Caleb here. Is Caleb here? Caleb? No, Caleb's not here. Last Sunday night, we had prayer night here, and I was kind of paired up with Caleb. He works for Young Life. Young man, wonderful young man. He's at camp. He's at camp. Good exams, right. He's at camp right now. So I can talk about him without him knowing. And Caleb is from Indiana, Pennsylvania. Went to Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and it's the college I went to. And while we're talking, he caused me to remind me of my first week at IUP, where I went to school, and then I went to church on Sunday, and it was a Presbyterian church, and they had a book table in the back, and these were free books. Well, that's like, you know, red meat to Larry. I mean, I'm all excited. But I decide I'm only going to take one book. I'm not going to embarrass myself. So I'm looking at all these books, and this old man sitting next to me, he says, "You know, God's Smuggler is a good book." I kind of, you know, look over, but I'm looking over here. "Yep, that God's Smuggler, that's a really good book." So I pick it up, and I flip over to the back, and it's a story about a man from Holland who smuggled Bibles into communist countries. This was back in the 50s and 60s. Okay, so I put it down, and I'm still, "Yep, that God's Smuggler." "Okay, fine. Are you happy I'm taking your gut book?" And this was, I'll date myself, this was the summer of 1970, and I just threw it up on my dresser, forgot all about it, and then suddenly it was several weeks later, I'm bored to tears, pick up the book and read it from cover to cover, could not put it down. It just inspired me that here was a man who was willing to put his life on the line to get the Word of God into places where it wasn't allowed. And just, here I am, I'm 17 years old, but I just thought to myself, you know, God, I would want to do that if you would use me. Prayer of a young man. Now, we'll fast forward 15 years later. I'm now married, 3 children. I'm a young pastor. I'm a bivocational, so I have a job also at a business college that I'm working at. And all of a sudden, I started to have this pain in my leg. And you know, a guy, you know, we just shake it off, no problem. And it gets worse and worse. My wife telling me how to go to the doctor. You know, that's what do they know? And, you know, I'm a guy. I'll get over this. And finally she says, honey, really? And I thought, okay. By the time I went to the doctor, I'm not kidding, I almost was on hands and knees crawling into the doctor's office. Well, they throw me into the hospital immediately. And for a week, they cannot figure out what's wrong with me. My leg is swollen up like a bowling ball. They run every kind of test. There's no explanation for this. Nobody knows what's going on. Fortunately, I was wise enough to be married to a registered nurse, who, by the way, I should mention it, on Sunday, last Sunday, my wife retired after 45 years of nursing. 45 years as a registered nurse. I think it's not an exaggeration. I probably wouldn't be alive today had I not been married to this woman. She knew of a specialist who had an office in Philadelphia, but we were living in Norristown, which was a suburb of Philadelphia. He had an office that he would come to once a week, and she said, you ought to talk to Dr. Utzinger. He would, you know, he could treat this. And they put him off. Finally, they were desperate, and they contacted Dr. Utzinger. He shows up at my office in the evening. You never see a doctor at night. I mean, come on. But here this guy, he comes. I'm sorry? Yes, he came to the hospital, right? He came from his office to the hospital. Thank you. And he looks at me. He says, you know, Larry, you're going to start feeling better in about a half an hour. I said, Doc, do not tease me. I've been, and I'm on pain meds. I am just a mess. And it's been a whole week, and I'm just in excruciating pain. Hadn't slept at all. And he did his little hoo-da-wah and goes out, and about half an hour later, I said, who was that masked man, you know? I mean, I am feeling good. Now, that started a relationship with Dr. Peter Utzinger. For the next 6 years, every 28 days to the day, my leg would swell up like a bowling ball, and I'd have to go in and he'd have to treat it. I would have this excruciating, incapacitating pain, and he would treat it, and it then would come back. I have a disease that is so rare, they don't even have a name for it. Less than 100 people in the world have what I have. He even wrote a paper on it. It was so unusual. I had 3 knee operations trying to deal with it. Nothing worked. Now, in the meantime, I'm a pastor. Come on. God, do your thing. Help me here. And nothing. I mean, I'm just suffering. I got 3 little kids. I want to play with them, and I can hardly do anything. In the meantime, though, you still got to function. So in between the 28 days, I can still, I mean, I have pain, but I can still get around. And I'm actually still ministering, and I got this guy that was had a lot of people praying for me. But this one young pastor, he came to me, he said, Larry, there's a pastor's conference next week. I'd like you to come. I said, I was trying to think of a good reason to get out of it. I had no interest in his conference. I had no interest in his denomination, which I thought they were trying to recruit me for. And I just thought, okay, fine, I'll go. I go to this conference. Now, this was probably now I've been being treated for this disease for probably well on 4 years at this point. And lo and behold, they have a presentation on missions to the Soviet Union. And they're smuggling Bibles in. And suddenly it hits me. That little prayer I prayed back as a 17-year-old. I went up to the organizer. I said, how do you get to do that? He said, well, come to the training. I said, okay. I went home. My wife said, how was the conference? I said, it's great. I'm going to Russia. She said, I'm going to the moon. Because it seemed about as likely. Really. I went there and suddenly felt like this was a calling. Made several trips. Now, in the meantime, it's this leg thing. I had to make the trips in between the 28 days. Your whole life has to be in that 28-day window. And now, in September of 1990, after 6 years of this condition, I knew that we were supposed to move to the Soviet Union. And I went to see Dr. Utzinger. And I said, Dr. Utzinger, we are moving to the USSR in January. He said, Larry, this is a bad idea. In a history of bad ideas, this is number one. He said, no one No one in the Soviet Union can treat you. Nobody in Eastern Europe can treat you. There's only a handful of people in the world that can treat you. This is dangerous. I said, I have no explanation for you. I can't explain it rationally. I just know this is what we're supposed to do. Well, I'll see you next month. That was his response. October, on the 28th day, I came in for the first time in 6 years. My leg, my knee had not swollen. And he looks at it. And he's doing his thing. He says, Larry, I believe your disease is in remission. I said, do you have any explanation for this? He says, no, I think you have a better explanation. Now, he is fascinated by this. This just doesn't go with his rational doctor mind. And this is one of the leading specialists. So he is going to speak at a conference in Stockholm, Sweden, in April of 91. We were going to arrive in January. He said, could I come and see you? By all means. By the way, that leg has never swollen since that January, since that September. Never once. 30 years gone. I still have pain. I still suffer in various ways. But that was unbelievable pain. It stopped. He comes in April of 91, comes to see us. He's shocked at the third world conditions of Latvia and the Soviet Union. He offers to take a doctor and intern them in America and then send them back. So Debbie's close friend, Dr. Andre Grajetana, volunteered to go. She received training in rehabilitation medicine. They went back, and Debbie and Andre started Mesa Zimlesis, a children's rehabilitation center, children with cerebral palsy. They just celebrated a few months ago their 25th anniversary. That institution that Debbie and Andre started has literally changed the lives of hundreds, and by influence, probably thousands of children. They have conferences that people come from as far away as Israel because of what they're doing there is so innovative. And I thought to myself, did I suffer all that pain for 6 years just for those children in Latvia? I don't know. It was a good trade-off. But in the meantime, by the way, I wasn't just, you know, I was a little busy myself. I was working in education, was able to start seminaries. We started several churches, did some church planting, was able to get a job as a professor at one of the leading colleges in the country. It gave me inroads into the political and commercial banking sectors of the country. I even had seminars where there were cabinet heads. Even once a prime minister was in one of my seminars, and had an opportunity with some others to reform the educational system of Latvia. It's the only country of 25 European countries where the Bible is used from K to 12 in the educational curriculum. A ministry was born from a pain in the knee that I could not get healed, directed to a place after a conference I didn't want to attend, and all began with a book I didn't want to read. God gets all the glory. And he gets all the glory. God is sovereign. If we take those baby steps of faith, you never know where it will lead you. And he wants to get us into the right place at the right time. And it's simply a walk by faith. And as we learned last Tuesday night at Regroup, it's a walk by faith working through love. And it's found in the community of believers, which is the church. And this is why we're told in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24, 25, and I'll end with this. Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Musicians, would you come forward? And let's stand together. I want to pray and just remind you that if you have a need today, and I don't want to minimize anyone's suffering, I don't want to minimize anyone's... God works in different ways. Some people are healed instantly and some suffer for years, as we saw in as we looked at Job. We don't know all the reasons why God does what he does. But he is, the Holy Spirit's the comforter, and he's there for us. And if you need prayer today, we invite you to go to the back and pray. But let me just close you in prayer.
Thank you for listening to this message from City Church, located in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. For additional information, please visit citychurchpa.org.